So I thought we might just start with a very simple couple of minutes for both of you to respond. Now, just so people know, in three quarters of an hour or so, Helen is going to just quietly disappear, not because she's throwing a tantrum about what we've been talking about, but because she's got other places she has to get to. So she will disappear, but we will continue the conversation. So there's no need to feel that as Helen departs that we have to stop and it's all over then. So, Helen, do you want to start?
Am I on? Okay. Look, I guess I'm here today because many of you would know that I have just released a report on poverty and what kids have told me in the last little while about the topic. So I'm not going to talk about that because that might come out through some questioning. But in my response to Jared, to this report, which I did have a read of, and I was saying to Jared it was quite good because I like it when you read things.
Only quite good?
Very good. I underplay. It was good. It was good. It was excellent. But what it did do, because it talk to the things that I've been really struggling with in this role for the last couple of years around what do we actually mean by some of the really practical things around what is disruption moving forward. So most of my time I spend thinking about the future because I'm working with the generation that's going to lead us into the future, and I'm constantly thinking about what is it that they need and what is the safety net for them that's not what it has been. So one of the things I would say is in investing in the safety net, I think it's... So I'll go through the four things that you've said in a slightly different take. So for me, investing in the safety net means it's got to move beyond what's currently configured as a safety net. And in fact, if we think about declining economic growth and increasing inequality and climate change and social polarisation and all of these really big kind of... and distrust in democracy and disillusionment with society, which I think are the really big issues that create and sit alongside disadvantage, what is it that safety net needs to look like when, in fact, economic growth into the future is not going to be about making stuff? So the stuff making's gone and the knowledge economy is what's happening. So for me, there's something about we need to invest in skills and education as that safety net. And I see too many kids whose productivity is lost because they've left the system at the age of 10 or 11. I think that's a major disruption and we need to actually tackle, and we need to add that to our safety net. When it comes to navigating the system, I think one of the things that always really challenges me is that as I get to sit at a kind of helicopter view of what's happening for kids in our state, one of the things that always happens is you can get all your people in the room, all of us in the room, and we will all say, the system's stuffed, the system doesn't work, this bit doesn't work, it's not working, it's siloed, it's fragmented. And when you sit down and have the conversation, no one's prepared to say that it's their bit of the system that's the bit that's broken. And so I think there's an analysis that needs to happen that says that we make up the system, that us as agencies, as policies, as business, as community, as government, whatever that is, we are the system. And if we keep on saying it's there, then we're never actually going to be able to disrupt this level of disadvantage. So I think that's a really critical point for me because I hear it all the time. It's all broken until you ask the person who you think their bit's broken and they say, my bit's fine. So I think that's a really critical part of the message. I think the other thing around data, I was really interested. I spend a lot of time in conversation about technology. And I say to people, I am a techno-optimist. I do think that the world will be like the Jetsons and it's going to be fantastic, and that the opportunities that technology will bring us will be able to solve some of the great problems of the last millennium. And so I do think that they'll find a cure for cancer through technology. I think all of these things are really possible. One of the things I think we need to do, though, is to think about human-centred technology as part of that data system. So rather than it being just about raw data, how do we create the platforms that are socially owned, and how do we create the technology that's actually going to drive some of this big change in the world? And I think it needs to get intuitive and predictive. So when you talk about the New South Wales data sets, and I hear good things and not so good things about those data sets, but one of the things I say is, why can't we create life-changing content by stealth? Why don't we use, why don't we gamify, why don't we do things to actually predict and prevent mental health, those kind of issues that are happening for our kids early, so that we end up in 2030 in a place where we have actually got a whole new way of being. And the last one I would say is something about service. Oh, so the service system, I think, is a really interesting one. We do need to definitely have evidence-based services, but we also need to reflect the fact that we can create our own evidence, that their innovation is actually often not evidence-based, and so we need to build in innovation into our service system as much as we need to have the evidence. But the real struggle and challenge with our service system, for me, is that, in fact, it's all about assessment and referral. And so we keep on reassessing and reassessing and reassessing, and the fact is there are no services. And so I keep struggling to find the intervention or the thing that actually changes people's ways and being and behaviour. So they're the four things, and that's my slightly different take, Jared, on your four things. But I think, yeah, excellent.
Thank you, Helen. Shona,
hey.
You've had just a little second more to think about it.
I have to go second.
Your reactions as you kind of have contemplated the report?
Yeah, you know, obviously my world is looking at, you know, as an Aboriginal woman and as a person who heads up Reconciliation SA, is absolutely around First Nations. And we do over-represent most of the system, where most of the need is needed and are categorised just based on race as being vulnerable, which is an interesting concept if you want to explore that one. But for me, I mean, obviously there wasn't much breakdown in this regards to First Nations people and our representation and how these key areas and focusing on these key areas are going to impact my community and the community here in South Australia. But, you know, I would, you know, there's a lot of... Nothing in here, I suppose, surprises me. I think we've heard it before, and I'm hearing it over and over again, especially around the data stuff, I have to say. I mean, I sit on the housing board here in South Australia, and that was one of the big key things that was brought up in a lot of the consultations, was access to data and the sharing of data and how we use that. And I think how we use that is a really important point, especially for First Nations people. I mean, you know, data and information has been used as a weapon for First Nations people, and has, I suppose, accelerated our disconnection from family and cultural beliefs. So I think, you know, I would, you know, even though quite supportive of that and sharing that information, I think we need to be mindful of this. I also think we need to be mindful that we've been given significant advice, and I will talk about it. I will talk about it till the cows come home through the Uluru Statement from the Heart, that community have given us some very considered advice. And were most gracious in this advice, because they invited the broader community to join them on the journey, is around the capacity for Aboriginal and First Nations people to be participants in discussions and decisions about all of this stuff that affects our lives. And not just from, you know, over in the corner over here having a bit of yarn and shouting across the room, because that's not what we mean, but participants in the discussions around the design and the delivery. You know, you're talking about databases, you're talking about service implementation and evaluation. We are participants in that, and we need to be there from the start, because we are able to interpret information that's specific for our community that the dominant culture just cannot do as much as they'd like to think they can. So that is what we're talking about. We're also talking about so a voice in that space, but also some truth-telling conversations. So I think people get caught up in the whole truth-telling conversation from a massacre perspective, the settler history. I also want to extend that a bit beyond its current remit into, let's talk about the honesty about our relationships with First Nations people today, around how services engage with First People today, and how do we listen, and how do we communicate, and how do we engage First Nations peoples in all of those places in which we touch and interact. And I think if I pick up on the third component, which is, you know, obviously treaty is the conversation that's held, but that really is essential about agreement making and how do we have conversations and the protocols we developed around our engagement and our working relationship and our social constructs. What is the agreement we're making with our First Nations peoples in that space? And I think we need to critically evaluate that. So if I want to belt home a message for me, and, you know, even though the Uluru Statement is quite a political statement and it sits way above in the political sphere, it doesn't actually sit up there. It belongs, and it was, you were invited to participate at a very real, practical level back in the workforce, back at home, as you interact with that society. And I think the other part of that is this is all based on the value we place in communicating and engaging with our First Nations peoples. Like, the value we place on our relationship, I think. And if we can critically evaluate that, I think we might find ourselves in a rude shock every now and then, because I don't think we value our relationships with First Nations people as we should. This is the uniqueness of our nation. It's a national identity conversation. Yeah. And I think we all need to evaluate that and about our unique, you know, what is the value we place on this relationship? And I think that will determine where we go to from here.
Thank you. So Shona, I mean, one of the things that strikes me, and you did touch on it, but I want you to go back there again. Helen was talking about the importance of honesty and the fact that in our systems we're not particularly good at being honest, particularly the bits of our system that isn't working in the ways that it should be. We don't often come out and share that story and talk about it openly and transparently. How difficult do you think has it been to actually get an honest conversation about the relationship with First Nations people?
It's insanely difficult. It requires an immense, you know, a self-reflection that's not been done before. It's about, you know, you sit and you look in the mirror and it's a really hard picture to see, and often, you know, there'll be a group of people that will, you know, stare at that mirror and have that really tough conversation. And there are some that would just quickly turn away. And I think we're at that junction, I think, in Australia at this point in time, where we're given the opportunity to do that. I've been astounded by the embracing of that opportunity by local, like grassroots communities and people who aren't connected to service agencies at all. They're just, you know, average, you know, community members, you know, Joe Blows from, you know, a little community up in, you know, might even be just in the southern suburbs of Adelaide, prepared to do that. People who have seen the benefit in doing that, yet our systems and our political systems have really struggled to embrace that concept of being and looking in the mirror around what contribution have we made as a collective, as a society, to the position in which we place First Nations in this country. And it's a really tough conversation, but that's what being brave, you know, like we often say, what are the words? Brave, bold and courageous. You know, how many of us have seen that in our strategic planning or business planning documents? But are we really? And are we really prepared to go, you know what, this is an uncomfortable conversation and I need to be comfortable in that space? So I think we've got a long way to go in that. But I have seen movements, especially this last year, in people willing to jump in there and maybe sit and soak it up a bit. I'm yet to see the next bit, which is, you know, having conversations with First Nations people, traditional owners, around how they're feeling uncomfortable in this space and what it means.
And is that essential if we're really to tackle and help support First Nations people to overcome some of the disadvantage that much of that community experiences?
Well, we need to be prepared, you know, like every relationship, whether it be, you know, married, you know, between, you know, partners and, you know, your loved ones, or whether it be, you know, organisational partnerships, we all need to be prepared. And be part of, you know, the preparedness to enter into a relationship, the preparedness to enter into an agreement, and it all requires us to be honest about where we're currently at, where we've come from and where we want to go to. I think that's the really important bit around where we want to go to, but you can't get there unless you're you fully understand the context in which your relationship has been developed. And for First Nations people, that has been built on one of aggression, one of violation, one of oppression. And it currently still exists because nothing has changed in our systems and in our structures to challenge that. So there still is oppression. You know, there still is, a violation of rights in so many different ways. And, you know, you can see that there are some policy decisions made nationally, that have violated human rights conventions, and that's been publicly known. So, you know, we need to understand that and accept that that's what's happened and understand what's driving those decisions that in 2020 we're still having conversations about the place of First Nations people in this country, whereas we thought that was settled in 67. Mm. But it's obviously not, and I've just got my numbers wrong the other day, but it's 53 years, and we're still in this conversation. Why are we stuck in this? What is it? You know, is our current systems feeling like they're not going to maintain control or maintain power? I'm not sure what the answer is, but I think it's worthwhile us having that conversation and be prepared to do so.
Mm. I was listening and would commend to any of you that haven't already done it to take the time out to have a listen to Rachel Perkins talk a little bit about, she's the Boyer lecturer this year, and she's reflecting on the statement from the heart and in fact reflecting on the work that her father actually did long before the statement of the heart. And I think it's well worth going back. So not only is it 53 years since the referendum, it's a very long time since the nation actually, the government, the federal government, came up with a proposal around addressing disadvantage that in fact didn't get implemented, didn't get the attention that it merited, and in fact was a precursor in all sorts of ways to the statement from the heart. So, you know, we do need to tie this together, and I think the Aboriginal community has been calling to us for a long time to pay attention to some of these things. Jared, there isn't much discussion about First Nations people and some of the issues of disadvantage that exist in that part of our community. Was there a particular reason for that?
I was saying to Shona before we got underway, it's certainly something that's on our list and probably something that we felt needed a lot more exploration and something that we would do in further reports. I think just picking up on Shona's point, to put a really practical point on it, anyone who didn't see Ben Wyatt's recent opinion piece in The Australian gives you a real glimpse into some of the practical issues in remote communities around our safety net and just, you know, access to the phone, to call government departments, dealing with payments that have been cut off, and how the system just doesn't work in that environment. And I thought that was, you know, an important insight that a lot more people should have into how different people in Australia interact with government systems and how difficult it can be.
Now, Helen, you've, in your short time in your commissioner's role, you have spoken to hundreds and hundreds of children across the state.
Thousands.
How do the issues of entrenched disadvantage reveal themselves in those conversations?
Yeah. So the reason that I did this latest report on poverty directly was, when I started in 2017, I was really clear to go and get my agenda set by kids. So I went out and spoke to hundreds then and asked them what were the kind of top five things they wanted me to concentrate on and how they were going to measure my success. The first thing they said was keep listening and asking kids their opinions because that doesn't ever happen. And the second thing they said to me was we need to really help poor kids. The third one was around education and who's included and excluded. The fourth one was about bullying, and the fifth one was about being prepared for adult lives. So number two was help poor kids. I kind of went, that's really interesting that came through, and that was done through a pretty technical analysis of the thousands of notes that kids gave me about the things they wanted me to do. And so when I then went out the following year, I found a real difference between the regional, so city and country, and I went back and did some conversations in the regions, and again, poverty became a really prevalent conversation. This is about, we can't, you know, we don't go anywhere because we can't afford petrol, we can't play sport because we can't afford the fees, we don't go here, we don't go there, and lives, and a lot of things around, we just, you know, cost of food, cost of living, those kind of issues, were and cost of internet. So kids talked about that a lot. So I had those, and then I went back and I was having the conversations on bullying, and again, this cost of living and the pressure and being different as being a reason why you get bullied or picked on came out. So by the time I'd had 3 years of, I guess, triangulated data that said kids are talking about this a lot and it's a really significant issue, I thought it was time to go back and have a detailed conversation with them about, when you say help poor kids, who are you talking about? Who are these poor kids? Are we talking just because that's how kids are? You know, they want to help and be kind and nice. Or are we talking about something that's much closer to home? And so in the piece I did on this, it was a general conversation through a survey with kids who may or may have not been poor. There was focus groups with kids who were definitely living in poverty, and then there was a summit of kids across South Australia where a few hundred of them came and talked about it within the kind of construct of the Sustainable Development Goals. So poverty is a real life issue in this state, and I've got some really kind of basic recommendations, basic achievable recommendations in this report. I think some of the things that really are clear to me is that we need to be working, and you know, this is a no-brainer, but we need to be at a micro MSO and a macro level on this stuff. So yes, we do need the kind of programs that Jared kind of mentioned in his introduction that are doing some of that work and Learning for Life and all of those things, which are fabulous, but that's not enough, because that's actually saying that there's something, there's a deficit in the individual that needs to be kind of addressed. This, and kids are really clear, saying that this is the way that our society is structured that is allowing so many kids to fall through these cracks and these gaps. And for me, the conversation that Shona's been talking about, which is truth-telling, is racism. And racism is a structural inequality that if we don't actually address it, we can't address poverty, we can't address any level of disadvantage. So it's about, I think, really going to all those levels.
Okay, 2 minute warning. I'll give you a chance to ask some of the questions that might be bursting in your minds, but in the meantime, I'm going to continue on. Shona, one of the things that is commonly, one of the common critiques, and it's not just for investments in Indigenous programs that have been addressing disadvantage, it is general, but it's certainly not uncommon for us to hear politicians talk about the fact that we've thrown millions at these problems and we haven't solved them. Is there some stuff that you think, what is it that has meant that we haven't been able to tackle the disadvantage that exists? Not specifically, if you don't want to, in the First Nations people's lives, but you know, broadly, if you'd like.
Yeah, sure. Like, it's look, it's, I think it's just as complicated as you know, what's that, wicked, or is
wicked.
That old now? Is that an old term or a new term now? But the wicked problem.
You can go with wicked for me. Wicked. I understand.
But I mean, yes, there has been millions of dollars thrown, and I think, you know, we're throwing it about in a white dominant culture system. You know, what are we saying? We're saying that it just, you know, the reason, you know, you can't invest in a system that contributed to the position that First Nations people find ourselves now in terms of overrepresentation in you know, all those key areas, like the closing the gap system. You know, one of all those outcomes is achieving, which is the attainment of Year 12 outcomes. So you can't keep investing in a system that is the one that oppresses people in the first place. You need to sit down and you need to think, how on earth do we rejig this in a manner that's actually meaningful and values First Nations people, values, you know, the cultures which are important, that shape family structures, that shape decision making, that shape contribution to society and community, you know, that's the conversation I think needs to happen. Look, I don't know the answer to any of this, and if we all knew the answer, then we wouldn't have a problem, would we? So it's certainly something that we need to be humble enough and sit down and listen to what community are telling us about what would work. And those programs that do work and we find that are kicking goals are the ones that are developed by families and communities on the ground. Let's, you know, maybe, you know, talking about evaluation and, you know, implementation, let's have a look at that. Because it's not about, you know, let's take that over here and place it over here. We all know that that doesn't work. Right. What does work is when people's, you know, opinions, the way they, you know, way communities think about problem solving for their particular community and their particular family, that's the stuff that works. And it's hard. That's the tough bit, because that's the bit government has to invest in, and that's hard work, and it takes longer, and that doesn't fit with a political cycle, and that doesn't fit with the funding cycle, because it's not easy and it doesn't happen in a 12-month period. So, you know, we need to start challenging that, and how can we put pressure on a system to enable those localised, grassroots, family-based initiatives that actually have meaning in somebody's life, and actually, you know, creates value in that system, in a system that needs to be reinstated.
Mm.
Jared, have you got any sense as to why we've lost the art of evaluation?
Well, it's been expressed to me in a number of different forms, and also what I've observed. One group of people will tell you that politicians don't like evaluations, particularly where they show that a signature policy or program of that government has not worked, or has spectacular failings, and I think that's right. I think there's also a case of institutional memory loss over time. Mm. And there was a period in the 90s, I think it was, where it was actually required at the federal level in budget proposals to come back for funding. And there are actually a lot of evaluations done during that period. But of course, that was dropped. I think it was in the early 2000s. We haven't seen it since, and so the kind of institutional memory and capability around evaluation has just disappeared. Now it's picked up by a lot of external firms. Some of those are good. Some of them are perhaps not so fantastic. And so that kind of thing, which should be a real part of the public service, I think, has been lost.
Is there any intersection between the fact that our academic institutions have been twisted in the last 20 years in such a direction of profit seeking or income seeking that in fact they too have lost the art of investing in evaluation or seeking to invest in evaluation, and that they're actually captured by the idea of attracting students and teaching students rather than contributing to the knowledge base in the way that they might have historically?
Well, it's interesting that during a few of our consultations, including with one international academic who was working with a lot of government departments on both implementation but also working on large data sets and new programs, and also working on evaluation at different levels. Both that person and a number of other people during our consultations raised the point that they think that there is a real role for a reinvigorated university sector in this area, whether it is, you know, research centres, groups that are specifically focused on social policy and social policy evaluation, and also perhaps getting a bit more involved in terms of working with governments. And I think some of the things that we see, particularly when you look at things like robo-debt, who else was in there working with the department on this? So having trusted, you know, third parties involved in policy development can be really helpful. And I think basically I would say that out of our consultations, people seem to think that the academic sector should be involved. I think there's also some issues around incentives, certainly in terms of some of the economists that I spend time with, who will talk about the incentives around getting into journal articles and things like that, rather than the kind of kudos that you get, for example, from working with government departments on projects. So I think universities definitely have a role to play.
So one last one before I cross to the floor. Helen, what do you think it might take for any of us to be a bit more trustworthy around the government using data in these kinds of ways? I can imagine that, you know, there's all sorts of profiling that would be the result of this. How could we trust them to profile for good, not for bad?
I mean, you know, I think it's really interesting. One of the things that's consistent, I think, in just about every large scale conversation I have with kids, they ask for six things. Let's see if I remember them. They ask for systems that are kind, that are inclusive, and are participatory. So that's what they want their systems to look like, whatever that might be. And they want the services that they go to be trustworthy, to be respectful of them, and to be accountable. And I keep thinking they are the consistent themes of a generation, which is why I'm so optimistic about the future, that if they actually work out the ways for us to do that, and if we can actually work out how we gain, you know, trust is a two-way street. It's not, you know, it's not a one-way. And so for us to trust, we need to be trusted. And the opposite is true. So I think we do need to spend a lot of time thinking, what is going to create generational trust? What is it that we can do in our everyday to make that happen? And I think there's a lot that we can do. We don't. And I have talked a lot about poverty to me is a right. It's a human rights issue. It's not an issue of services and welfare. And so we need to stop having the conversations to the level that we do about controlling individual behaviour or controlling finances or whatever that might be. It is actually about having a far more citizenship-based kind of approach to this and saying this, people have a right to not live in this level of disadvantage. I think it's about, for me, always elevating up and trying to be the best version of ourselves.
Thank you. All right, now's the opportunity for...
He's telling me I have to leave, but if there's a question for me...
If anyone's got a question for Helen, this is your last opportunity to ask it.
Yes, they're all on my website, everything I do, because I'm believing in this be transparent and accountable stuff that kids are telling me. Yep, so it's up there. If you particularly want a pretty one, you have to call me.
We've got one question from Evelyn. Do you want to introduce yourself and say where you're from?
Evelyn, I think it's really interesting that when I went out on a poverty conversation, I did go and test the poverty word before I did it, because I thought, do kids get poverty? Like, they might know what poor kids are, but do they understand poverty? And should I be calling it disadvantage? Should I be calling it exclusion? These kind of nicer words. They gave me a resounding call it what it is, because exclusion for the next generation is a different conversation. So the inclusion-exclusion is a diversity conversation and a gender conversation, not a poverty conversation. So I think that's part of the thing. The other thing they said to me was really about one of the things they talk about is you've got to start talking about this stuff. We get told everything we learn in school about poverty in the humanities is about third world. We don't get taught about it in Australia. We don't know that it exists. We want to actually have a public conversation about poverty based on the stuff that you're telling us. When I had the summit with kids, 200 kids, and they were like, and we had a panel of people, not one kid in any of the surveys identified disability as related to poverty. It just didn't come up anywhere. I had a panel with a young woman with a disability who talked about the impact. In the stuff that came out from that summer, disability was so high. This is about a conversation. If we don't have the discourse, then they're not going to actually engage in the solution to the extent that they could possibly.
Can you just join me quickly in thanking Helen for her contribution this afternoon?
Sorry, I have to go talk to kids, which is what I get paid to do.
Not that she's paid to talk to us either. So, other questions from the floor? If you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself and saying where you're from. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you. On the first question about the kind of definitional or issues around disadvantage versus poverty versus inequality, we did a study on inequality last year. So we sort of decided in this one to focus on almost every study that I looked at on inequality in 2018, and there were a lot of them. Regardless of the political persuasion of those who did it, they all tended to come down to a landing where they said focus on those most in need or those most disadvantaged or those in greatest poverty, for example. So that was part of the reasoning of focusing a bit more on disadvantage rather than the issue of inequality and looking into all the different measures and issues around inequality in this piece. We didn't really make a conscious decision, I don't think, around poverty versus disadvantage. We had a long discussion around the idea of entrenched disadvantage versus disadvantage. And we were reluctant, I think, in many respects, to get too drawn into an entrenched disadvantage definition because we were concerned about who are the people that you miss and also how do you end up coming up with... You know, you end up in one of these debates about deserving versus undeserving. So we didn't want to get too narrow in terms of our definitions, and that's why I guess we've talked a lot about people stuck and at risk of getting stuck, which means really anyone below the poverty line would fall into that sort of area. So, and I know these kind of discussions around some of the definitional issues are really live within the sector and also amongst a lot of economists and academics as well. But yeah, so we have had some discussion around that, and I have to say there's different views even internally within CEDA around some of those sorts of issues. On the community attitudes piece, I think you're right. Certainly in the survey work that we do, it shows that, for example, people want fantastic health, social services, aged care. When you ask them questions then about tax, they want lower taxes. And as someone put it, I think, that it seems like Australians want a Scandinavian welfare system and a US tax system. So there is kind of that cognitive disconnect, I think, amongst things. The other thing that you see in surveys, and you see this in Victoria, I've seen this in some of the Department of Human Services work that they've done on homelessness. Everyone's really concerned about homelessness in Victoria, and they don't think that people should not have a roof over their head. But then when you start to ask them about, well, what should the government or what should others do about it, that's when you start to get a real fragmentation of response or just the, I don't know. So I think it's kind of having those public debates at a level deeper than we currently do, and that requires, I think, leadership wanting to have those discussions and debates. And one of the things that people said, I think, I can't remember which, whether it was Brisbane or Sydney, was that politicians don't like the word poverty, and therefore poverty is not a kind of common point of discussion or debate. So it's a bit, the truth telling and needing to have tough conversations. This is probably one of them if you want to get to that next level of what do we do about some of these things and build consensus.
Shona, have you got a sense of the follow-up to that in some regards to... sometimes we ask the public or we ask ill-informed people for their opinions about all sorts of things. So, I'm struck by the idea that we go out and ask people about how we should solve homelessness and imagine that they will have a solution to it. But we don't actually go and ask the people who, in fact, know something about that. And I heard in what you were saying originally that was one of the issues that makes it very difficult to address disadvantage, is that, in fact, people don't come and have the conversations directly with the people affected. Is that an issue?
Oh, completely. And I think, the whole lived experience conversation is, absolutely... essential, and I think sometimes we don't ask the right people because it's it clouds the conversation, like it's on purpose, because knowing the answers to things or hearing the reality of it requires a significant amount of change, and that's a hard thing to do. And that's that whole preparedness to change in the conversation, our system preparing itself. And I think there is an avoidance. In terms of First Nations space, there's an avoidance to talk to community because there's this, this perception of, you were talking, Pam, before around, if we start giving to the poor, they're going to come, like the Oliver, please, sir, can I have some more? I think that's certainly a theme that's been coming up in my conversations where, there's a scaredness or a fear to go out and going, well, what can we give? Does that mean you're going to keep coming back for more? Because that's our experience in the past. And that whole conversation, and we keep throwing money to Aboriginal communities, we're not getting any bang for our buck. But I think the lived experience conversation is completely, essential component to being truthful, being honest, but also building that integrity. But like cultural integrity as well, which I'm hot on around, having a look at how we operate, and is it one that, we are quite a diverse community. I'm not just talking about First Nations. There's a whole community that we have now in society in Australia that's not necessarily European, Anglo-Saxon, and Christian.
White fella like me.
I didn't say that. I would never say that. We are an extremely diverse community, and there is an amazing opportunity that comes with that. If only we give our permission to embrace it and to utilise that, because I think that's our greatest strength in our society, is to utilise our diversity, and I think that's how we go forward from here.
Other questions? Off you go, Anne.
Into a political system or to self-interested bureaucrats or anybody else.
I think you've actually articulated the issues around evaluation far better than I did. I think in that, you know, in talking about those different interests and where everyone comes. I think, you know, there's a bit more work for us to do on this, I think, particularly in relation to this issue of evidence, implementation and evaluation. And I think part of it is thinking about some of these things on a continuum that in different areas, different levels of complexity and the different stakeholders at play in different areas and the level of agreement that there is lends itself to different sorts of processes in terms of building consensus but also in terms of, you know, the research process and the policy process that you adopt. Now, I haven't seen too many contemporary examples of really good process. I know that Percy Allen has been doing some work which has been released recently showing that there's actually agreement between all sorts of people of different political persuasion about how poor different policy processes are, and they look at a number of kind of high profile policies made at the state and federal level. I think there's something in that and looking at it with that lens. If we have people with fundamentally different beliefs on what the solution is, but they both agree that the process is not right and not getting to the right issues, to me that seems like a platform from which we can start to have more of the kind of sensible debate around how we overcome some of the more fundamental issues, because it does certainly the policy kind of reforms that I've been involved with, where the process was good, generally it was still difficult. But the outcome was far better, and as much as you still had stakeholders who didn't agree with the outcome, they were willing to respect the process that you went through.
I was just going to pick up on the back end of what you were asking around, you know, I spend my entire job at Reconciliation SA in creating relevance of reconciliation for you know, corporates and for governments and for, you know, little community groups. And that's my gig, is to create relevance. I think that's what needs to be created in this space is, you know, poverty and disadvantage needs to be made relevant to the decision makers and the powers that be. At this point in time, they have no, there's no anchoring point for them. They are completely, you know, they've got the statistics and they've got the evaluations and they've got all that, but it's still, and they understand it from that perspective, but its relevance to them and the way that our society functions isn't there. And I think that's an important area that we've yet to evolve. It's certainly something that can be achieved, I think. But I think that relevance is a really important component to this. Agreed. Yeah. Agreed. Yep.
Other questions? Your question out? Surely not. Not a smart group of people like you. Don't forget to introduce yourself, if you wouldn't mind. Truly,
seems to me that, you know, with a combination of thoughtful process that are really about what needs to be done, with a fairly thorough sifting of the current evidence, including the identification of some key gaps. I mean, one of the things I find really interesting here, I have an association with the Melbourne Institute at Melbourne University, and they deal with ILDA and large bodies of data. So the pathways out of poverty is a really helpful way to be thinking about this. Sorry, this is more discursive than I had meant to be, but really highlighting, I think, the choice of process, the use of timeframes in layering the solutions that are dealing with, and wherever possible, doing something useful and welfare increasing in a short time as you possibly can. Oh, by the way, our observation in our first inquiry on the procurement is that a lot of the programs that are directed towards this advantage are horribly fragmented here and elsewhere. So, your thoughts, please. Is there a preferred way into this problem that can make progress?
It's interesting that you mentioned the Productivity Commission and their processes, and I agree. I mean, if you look at the kind of rigour, both in terms of consultation but also analysis, not every PC report ends up with big reform, but some of them have certainly initiated significant reform. And perhaps some of the more contemporary issues have been around what's given to the Productivity Commission as an inquiry, as opposed to what they've done, which has generally been pretty sound.
Can I just separate the commission from the process?
Yep.
Because I think that business of evidence gathering is terribly important in these sorts of questions.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. So, I mean, if I, you know, in my economist's world, I would love to see a body like the Productivity Commission or a similar independent body undertake a rigorous, detailed examination of this issue. And certainly I think following the Productivity Commission's inequality study, there were some who were suggesting that the Productivity Commission should be that body. But it would be a good circuit breaker, I think, to have an independent body look at this issue.
Some of us have suggested previously that in order for the Productivity Commission to maybe add to its expertise would be to invite some people who weren't necessarily specifically drawn there from backgrounds in largely economics and some of those issues, that in fact it would... Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
Sorry, I wasn't trying to advocate productivity so much process.
No.
Which is fundamentally about gathering evidence, identifying gaps, points of agreement, testing the views that come out of that. But with one of the key objectives being to increase the constituency for reform, which is a point that people like Gary Banks and other heads of the Productivity Commission have been pushing. I'm not trying to advocate economics here, this is a really good question.
So, Shona, the Uluru statement was in fact the result of consensus building. Incredible discussion across all of the First Nations people across the land. How did they set about that exercise of building consensus around, you know, what ultimately was a brief document that said this is what we really feel we want and need as a group of nations?
Correct. It's decades of work, and I think how am I going to say? So I think, and they were forced. So they were forced into that very short statement, and it was
And the statements, not necessarily what they were really after, but it was what they knew that they could realistically achieve and put forward something that was realistic in their eyes. But it was, you know, so it went back way before Julia Gillard. Like, those conversations were happening then. Those consultations for that happened, you know, for decades. And, you know, I'll put it on the table. There's a line of conversation that happens. Yes, there were people that walked out of that Uluru convention in May 2017. There was a group of people that walked out. There was, some people that weren't happy with the process. But, you know, it is no different than what happens on the corner of King William and North Terrace. You know, 2 weeks out of every four or 3 weeks out of four with a sitting week. There was constituents, there were delegates sent from around the country. So they had their regional forums and information was collected there, and the drafting of the statement happened after those consults. Delegates came in to the convention at Uluru, 250 of them from across the country straight in, and they debated. They sat there just like any other sitting day. You know, it was their parliament, it was their ground, it was governed by, you know, leaders that they had sought, who drove those consults. And, you know, there were disagreements, and there were, just like it happens in North Terrace, and I have to say it was more civil. Having worked in Parliament for a couple of years, you know, it was a much more civil experience than I've had, you know, and I loved working in Parliament, I have to say, but, you know, it was an amazing sense of First Nations democracy and diplomacy that happened at that convention. And, you know, I don't know what other group of people, if you want to call it that, I don't like saying that, but if you want to, what other collection of people that would have such patience and humility to still just push ahead regardless of the obstacles that were put in their place. And, you know, so, you know, I think it, you know, even goes back to when Bob Hawke rejected the Barunga statements from Far North, and so he decided to put in a reconciliation process. So, what's it, 10 years we'll have reconciliation in Australia. So, you know, so we went through the CAR, Council of Aboriginal Reconciliation, that happened for 10 years, and guess what? We weren't reconciled after 10 years. So then we put in the Reconciliation Australia, which is now legislated. So, you know, so we put that in, and that was how many years ago? And so there's been a whole range, and then there was promises from the Stolen Generations and the famous Redfern speech. Look, I could go on. But the patience First Nations communities have had and the humility to sit there and go, yep, all this has happened and we get all that, but, you know, we just want to be a part of the conversation. We just want to be included. We want to have a right. We want these rights, and, you know, we want to have a right-based conversation. We just want these rights to participate fully in our home and participate, allow us to travel where we want to travel, you know, allow us to, you know, buy food if we want to buy food, because that's what it's getting down to, if you want to, you know, call it, you know, and whatever you think about the welfare card or whatever you think about that, they all have impacts on First Nations people that we truly don't understand, because we truly haven't asked the questions to the people who are living the everyday of having to go and purchase food with those cards. Or, so if I can get any message across, it's, you know, people who are living it are the ones that need to have the say.
So, Jared, how do we build into these processes? And, you know, let's take up the idea that we get the PC interested in progressing this, and we convince the government to commission them to do so. How do we ensure that the lived experiences of people are put front and centre in the process, so that we don't have to be another 50 years down the track in order to, or 100, in order to actually get some of that resolution that we're searching for?
Yep. So I think we should examine our processes of consultation on this stuff. I mean, we have all of these policy processes, we have regulatory impact statement processes, we have so many processes, yet an OECD study called Risks That Matter asked people about, in the general population, I think it was 19 countries, 20,000 respondents, something like that, whether they felt like they were part of the policy process and that they had actually a say, and whether the policy process was as it should be. And most of them said no. So clearly this is a fundamental failing across a number of countries. So we do need to examine what our processes are, and often consultation is tick the box. It's to say that we went and spoke to some people and you know, we took their views into account as we developed our policy. What can we do to make it more broad-ranging, more authentic, and real, and recognise that some of those consultations and conversations will be difficult, and they may be tense at times, but if we can manage them, then we're probably going to get to a better outcome.
One more question before I get thrown off the stage. No, one more question? Question for you. Should people who are currently experiencing some form of disadvantage be more cranky? Should they actually be more comfortable yelling and screaming and pointing out the fact that their circumstances are inadequate, lousy, horrid, or should they keep quiet, as some have been suggesting? Grimaces on the faces. Anyone want to respond, Sarah? Any other? Yeah, there should be a lot of people on the streets. Not because they haven't got somewhere to live. Can you join me in just saying thank you very much to our panel?